America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Holy cow, our mic beam. There we go. 6 minutes past the hour. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman with you. Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama, this is from the Associated Press, accused the Bush administration yesterday of pursuing a policy of social Darwinism that leaves every man and woman struggling. The Illinois senator said the attempt to divvy up the government into individual tax breaks may be tempting, but he says this isn't what made America great. Interesting. By the way, a lot in the news today that we will be getting to, from Gonzalez Gate to John McCain biting the dust to what's the latest with the attack on Iran and others. But I want to just pursue this point, follow this point, carry through on this point a little bit for a little to at least. And I want to talk about the draft as well and talk about this point for a second. Ilan Jorno is with us. He's a junior fellow and research associate at the Ayn Rand Institute. The Ayn Rand Institute being one of those think tanks that, based on the writings of Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and many of her essays on objectivism, Ayn Rand being the thinker in the 1950s who came up with the notion of objectivism, which to a large extent has informed many of the thinkings of the Libertarian Party, which in turn has informed much of the thinking of people like Grover Norquist in the modern-day so-called conservative movement, although I realize that the Ayn Rand folks would disavow all of them because none of them are sufficiently pure. Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org is the website. Ilan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us here. You have published a piece over at Ayn Rand called Bush and Chavez, the two amigos, the dos amigos. Tell me about this.
Well, this is in response to Bush's visit to South America, his attempt to win support there. And as you probably remember, he came out and said that America is committed to advocating social justice, in his words, in South America through aid and other efforts. And I think that that is a complete perversion, and it's a betrayal of America, and it's a height of injustice to Americans and to the people in those countries. Our president, as the head of a country founded on individualism and political freedom, should be advocating when he's anywhere else in the world, and especially in South America, is freedom and political and economic freedom. I mean,
now our Declaration and Constitution talk a lot about community, about the general welfare. I mean, I thought that we were a nation founded on the concept of on the core concept of social justice. What's wrong with the president going down to South America and saying that we're in favor of social justice?
Well, you can be in favor of justice, but what does social justice mean? It means that some people are going to be looted for the sake of providing unearned wealth to other people. And that is the height of injustice, because it means taking from someone who earns something and giving it to someone who has not.
Taking from the rich and giving it to the poor, basically. I mean, let's just boil this right down.
Sure.
And you're suggesting that this is a variation.
To the able.
Yeah, you're suggesting that this is a variation on Marx's philosophy of, you know, from those who can afford, basically, and to those who, I forget Marx's phrase.
Yeah, it's cut-rate Marxism. It's diluted and made to seem
American. And I would submit to you that instead what it is it's saying, okay, there are some people out there who have used the game of the system that we, the people, brought into being. We brought into being the court system. We brought into being the monetary system. We brought into being the educational system. We brought into being the commons, the transportation system, all these things that are necessary in order for a business to even exist. We authorize businesses and we give them special privileges. We give them limited liability in a whole variety of ways. Businesses can kill people and not be held to account in the way that individuals do. And in fact, there's a long history of that. So we give all these special privileges to business, and in exchange for that, if they make a large profit and a big pile of money, in exchange for their use, their heavy use of those commons that we created, they get to pay a heavy tax. What's wrong with that?
Well, number one, who's the we who created this? I challenge the premise that the collective society, such as you suggest, has created all these goods and services. They're done and made and invented by companies and individuals, And after the government took a lot of them over, it's come to seem as if they're publicly run. But it's not true. I think the reason that companies deserve to keep their wealth and not be taxed is that they have earned it. They have created new wealth.
But they have earned it within the context of society. Those companies and individuals are able to do those things because of the education, the life basically that was provided to them by the society into which they were born. You're suggesting that there's no such thing as a social contract or a social compact, that we're all just lonely individuals out here working for our best and most selfish self-interest, and that somehow is going to produce some positive good. And I'm suggesting that we're all part of society. You can't avoid it.
I agree we're part of society, and a society is a huge benefit to individuals because in a society, people can come together and create railroads, and they can come and create factories, and people can come and trade goods and services.
But they can't do that in a vacuum. They can't do that
until the
people collectively first provide laws which say, if you build a railroad, we will have police who will defend your private property. If you build a railroad, we will give you limited liability from lawsuits and things
Let's separate out what the government should be doing as its function is to protect the rights of property and freedom of everyone. And then separate from that the kind of corporate welfare that is improper and should not exist. The government should not be subsidizing, should not be giving special tax breaks to anyone. Now, that is precisely what has corrupted this system. Now, what I'm talking about is we should have anyone who opens a company or trades in anything has a right to protection from the government.
Wait a minute.
That is not something that society...
You just said the government should not be giving special tax breaks to anyone. But what if we, the people, collectively... I mean, what if there is actually a social consensus, an absolute consensus among society, that it might be, for example, a good idea if we used less oil, so we are no longer having to fight wars in foreign nations to get oil. And one of the ways to do that is to insulate homes. And so we give everybody who owns a home a $1,000 tax break if they insulate their home. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with using our tax policies to produce social good?
Well, number one, taxes as such are immoral. So number two, there is no such
taxes
thing
are
as
the cost
society.
Of admission to civil society.
There is no such thing as a communal society. I think this is a fiction that goes back all the way to Rousseau and to Kant and to Hobbes and others who seem to think that society is some kind of organism and the individuals who compose it are really just cogs. They don't have their own value.
It wasn't Hobbes and others. Hobbes is taking your position. Kant, I'd say Rousseau is taking my position.
Well, Rousseau definitely, but there are elements in Hobbes that also imply a collective society.
What, in Leviathan?
Well, yeah, everyone is subordinate to the state.
Yeah, but his point was that without the iron fist, you know, badly paraphrasing or quoting Hobbes, without the iron fist of the state or the church, then the inherent evil nature of humans will emerge and society will degenerate to its original state where life is brutish, short, and nasty and short. I mean, that...
But ultimately...
I reject that, and I think you do too.
Well, I definitely reject it, but what I'm getting at is that the idea of a collective organism that is society that hands out benefits and collects revenues, it is not the way to think of the world because it doesn't function that way.
But it does function that way.
No, it doesn't. I mean, we are all individuals. That is society, a whole collection of individuals.
But the description of societies that I've laid out is how every country in the world is working, and I defy you to point to me one country that's run along objectivist principles in the history of humanity that has been successful.
The vast errors that exist do not prove that it's right. I mean, virtually every country has got a corrupt view of society. That is part of the problem we're facing.
To take this to the next step,
people do X to X is right. That is not valid.
So I would assume then that you would also be opposed, for example, and think that any conservative or objectivist should be opposed to any form of national service. If you think paying taxes is immoral, then showing up to volunteer at a hospital or work in the military, that should be illegal too.
Let me just clarify something. I didn't say paying taxes is immoral. I think taxation is unjust and immoral. But to answer your question...
Forced taxes.
Yeah, to answer your question about national service, I oppose compulsory service. If someone wants to volunteer his time freely, he can do it. And I've volunteered for certain things that I'm committed to. But that doesn't mean that you should be forced to.
So in other words, when we're born into society, we have no obligation to that society.
Exactly. You are an individual, and you own yourself, and you owe nothing to other people, neither morally nor politically. And that is the way in which societies grow and prosper, when individuals
are free. And I think that point is the clear and bright dividing line between conservative and liberal thought in America, and you said it very well. Alain Giorno, thank you very much. AyanRand.org, the website, the Ayn Rand Institute. Good talking with you, Alain. 16 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Well, my face may not be pretty and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, I got my invitation. Did you get yours? Well, maybe if you don't live in Oregon. Here, the Oregon Republican Party is throwing a dinner with their featured guest, Karl Rove. And I'm invited. I get to meet Karl Rove and U.S. Senator Gordon Smith and Congressman Greg Walden, and it'll only cost me $1,000. Somehow I think I'll pass. It's going to be Friday the 13th here in Portland. I don't know, $1,000. And that's it. I mean, you know, this is if you've got the money, you can participate in democracy. If you don't have the money, then you're out of luck. Which brings us back to this whole idea of at what level are we obligated to be a part of and a participant in the society in which we live? We touched on this yesterday. And in particular my conversation with Charlie Rangel, and I never really took the time to make my point. I want to make it. I'm going to do it once. I've written about this before. In fact, back in 2004, on May 5th of 2004, I wrote a piece about it for CommonDreams.org called Time to Reconsider Jefferson's Call for Universal Service. And I just want to lay it out. Many of the world's mature democracies, in fact, most of them, require every high school graduate to serve 1 or 2 years, typically 1 year, in either the military or nonprofit service. At first blush, this may seem like, you know, some kind of oppression by government, but history shows it's actually one of the best ways to prevent a military from becoming its own insular and dangerous subculture. And I would submit to you that we are seeing that now. To prevent the lower ranks of the military from being overwhelmed by people trying to escape poverty, and I would submit to you that we're seeing that now, and to keep military actions of the government accountable to the people. And we're not seeing that now, and we should be. Thomas Jefferson first suggested that we not only should not have a standing should not only have a standing army, but that there should be some level of national service. He wrote a series of letters about this in 1787 to James Madison when the Constitution was debating, urging that it be written into the Constitution. Here's a letter that he wrote on February 12, 1788. This was a year later to a friend of his, Mr. Dumas. He said, with respect to this is after his correspondence with Madison. He says, with respect to the new government, 9 or 10 states will probably have accepted by the end of this month. The others may oppose it. Virginia, I think, will be of this number. Beside other objections of less moment, I'm quoting from Thomas Jefferson, she will insist on annexing a Bill of Rights to the new Constitution. Now, Jefferson was the guy who was pushing so hard for this. That is a bill wherein the government shall declare that, 1, religion shall be free. 2, printing presses free. 3, trial by jury preserved in all cases. 4, no monopolies in commerce. And 5, no standing army. Upon receiving this Bill of Rights, she will probably depart from her other objections. Now, how was it that Jefferson was saying there should be no standing army and there should be national service? Alexander Hamilton hotly debated this thing. Volume 29 of the Federalist Papers is all about this. This is what Hamilton said, and he was a conservative. He was one of the conservative of the early days. He said, if standing armies are dangerous to liberty, and this was something that the conservatives and liberals both agreed on, to a large extent, not across the board, an efficacious power over the militia in the body to whose care the protection of the state is committed ought, as far as possible, to take away the inducement and pretext to such unfriendly institutions. In other words, if we, the people, are the military, then you don't have to worry about what happened in Pakistan where the military overthrows a democratically elected government. You don't have to worry about what happened in Iran, where the military overthrows a democratically elected government. You don't have to worry about what happened in Egypt, where the military overthrows a democratically elected government. A citizen's militia, said Hamilton, appears to me to be the only substitute that can be devised for a standing army, and, in fact, the best possible security against a standing army. As President Jefferson again tried to revive his argument, this is now in 1800, he slashed the army. He inherited an army of several hundred thousand soldiers. He slashed it down to just 3,000, closed forts, cutting costs. He couldn't kill off the army altogether because the citizens' militia had never been really formalized. But he was morally offended by the idea of an army that people would join only because they were so poor that there was no other way to get an education or a job. In fact, he wanted free public education. That's why he started the University of Virginia as a free university. He said, it is more a subject of joy that we have so few of the desperate characters which compose modern regular armies. He noted the so-called voluntary armies depend on a pauper class for their existence, what he called a pauper class. As he wrote to Dr. Thomas Cooper, our men are so happy at home that they will not hire themselves to be shot at for a shilling a day. Hence, we can have no standing armies for defense because we have no paupers to furnish the materials. He noticed that such a system of universal service, and he quoted the Greeks and the Romans. He said the Greeks and the Romans had no standing armies, but every male in their nation was a member of the militia. He said such a system of universal service was proposed to Congress in 1805 and subsequently, and on the last trial, was lost, I believe, by a single vote only. Had it prevailed, the War of 1812 would not have happened. Instead of burning our capital, we should have possessed theirs in Montreal and Quebec. We must now adopt it, and all will be safe. This, by the way, was the origin of the Second Amendment, his idea that everybody should participate. You know, it was Herbert Hoover who said, it's old men who declare war, but the youth who must fight and die. The way to stop that, national service. 27 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
There's a superstore out by the interstate. I get my shirts and my tires and my eggs in one place. I guess it's convenient. It is what it is. We save a few dollars, but what is the cost? When they don't know your name, seems like something is lost. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where a man with a vision can still make his way, where the middle guy says to the big boys, you can't shut me down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the liberal left, or is it the radical middle, or is it simply the traditional American viewpoint? 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, one more quote from Thomas Jefferson before we wrap this up and go to your calls in history. Jefferson found justification for his opinion that every male between the ages of 17 and 47 should participate in some way, and those who did not want to, who had a religious or moral objection to serving in the military, should find some other way to serve for a year in their country. For this, but the idea was he didn't think that there should be a standing army. In other words, he would have been a violent opponent of the military and industrial complex. And I want to put myself on record as being an opponent of the military industrial complex. I think that we could have a much better defense of this country with probably less than half of the military budget that we have now. We have bases in 122 countries. It's absolutely unnecessary. What we're doing is we're protecting our oil interests all around the world, and we shouldn't even be worried about oil interests all around the world. There's more than enough sunlight and wind power and wave power to be supplying this country. But anyhow, Jefferson said, this is, again, a letter that he wrote on September 10th, 1814. He said, "The Greeks and the Romans have no standing armies, yet they defended themselves. The Greeks by their laws and the Romans by the spirit of their people. They took care to put into the hands of their rulers no such engine of oppression as a standing army. Their system was to make every man a soldier and oblige him to repair to the standard of his country." In other words, to come out and defend his country whenever that was reared. In other words, whenever the country was invaded. "This made them invincible, and the same remedy will make us so." Now, if your understanding of the history of the Greek and Roman empires is limited to the last centuries of them, when they became aggressive, when they reached out, then, you know, that seems to contradict. He was talking about the early years of those empires, obviously. So, anyhow, your thoughts on this and other topics. Robert in San Francisco, California, listening on The Quake, where I will be broadcasting live tomorrow morning, in fact, and tomorrow afternoon, John Scott and I will be doing a gig. It's all over at quakeradio.com if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I can't believe, where are you digging these guys up? This Atlanta Journal fella, he's got a deficiency or something. I mean,
are the people who are providing the thinking for the vast majority of the major decision makers in today's Republican Party, Robert.
I mean, this guy says we have no moral obligation to society. I mean, who wiped his butt when he's a kid and wiped his nose? I mean, what if we just decided we can make a buck and we're just going to feed that little kid some garbage with some kind of poison in it? Because we've got no moral obligation to that little kid.
Well, they would suggest, as you know, right now you have the Bush administration, this is in the news today, trying to disembowel the Endangered Species Act. Bush administration officials from the LA Times said Tuesday they were reviewing proposed changes to the way that the 34-year-old Endangered Species Act is imposed. They don't think that there should be a USDA to make sure that our food is safe. They don't think that there should be an FDA to make sure that our drugs are safe. These guys really and truly believe this ideology, and they are in power in the White House.
Yeah, that's a big problem, and look at how they got to power. I mean, this whole de facto government thing.
Yeah.
If you even consider that there's things going on behind the scenes, people don't understand quite what happened. When 9/11 happened, Cheney said we're going to continuity of government. If you look in the 80s, they created the secret government. It's not.
Oh, it goes back before that. It goes back to the 70s. It goes back to Plan B. It goes back to Wolfowitz when Cheney were the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary and the Chief of Staff Rumsfeld and Cheney Rumsfeld were you know basically you know running the Ford administration, and they created the Plan B, this whole operation that Wolfowitz was doing to hype the Cold War. Yeah, no, absolutely, Robert. Good point. Anyhow, but I want to stay on the topic of, do we have an obligation to society? Is it the other way around, or should it be balanced? Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Maurice.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
First and foremost, before I get started, could I hear your response on my phone? Because I just turned off my computer, and obviously in Atlanta, I can't hear you anymore.
Oh, okay. So, great, but I'll get better, Maurice.
What's up? In any case, I wanted to take the flip side, I wanted to take the argument of the gentleman from the Ayn Rand Foundation to its logical conclusion, and ask the question, then, what does society owe the individual? Because according to his line of logic, then, his parents would have just birth him and thrown him out in the street and allowed him to bootstrap himself up.
Well, no, they acknowledge the existence of family. They don't acknowledge the existence of a society larger than family.
Well, I guess then ultimately society doesn't owe him justice then.
You could make that argument, and again, they will say, well, we're not quite that radical. We think that there should be police, and there should be laws to protect private property, and there should be armies to protect property, that is specifically the property of our nation. But beyond that, no, there should be, you know, it should be every man for himself, and that's the bottom line. And I think you're right. You identify, you know, one of the fundamental problems with it. Jeff in San Francisco wants to defend the libertarian point of view. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, just a tad. Hey, Tom. Well, first of all, I've always been impressed by the writings of George Orwell, and I've read a little bit of Karl Kraus. I don't know, he's a German guy who was into semantics, and I have a semantic point. The term contract means an agreement between two or more parties for doing or not doing of something specified. And kids, you know, infants, newborns, can't enter into contracts. So that term social contract always bothered me. How can somebody who can't sign any legally enforceable contract, vote, do anything, be in a contract. So I would suggest maybe we could come up with some other term besides contract, because that just sounds like what, you know, Orwell would call an abusive language, and I always worry about those kinds of things.
Well, there is a point of at which, you know, there's the age of reason. You know, it's first the 7-year-old age that the Catholic Church recognizes, and then, you know, puberty, and then you know, over 18 and over 21 that we as a society recognize. And the point is that, you know, arguably beyond those points, we have engaged in a social contract. It's very simple. You know, people say, well, I don't want to pay taxes. Well, it's fine. Go live someplace else.
Okay. That being said, I just have, and I don't think it's just semantics. I think language has, you know, the language shapes the argument that we're making here. And here's another thing, I guess. The idea of society, it seems like, you know, you're maybe trying to place a straw man in the side of this Ayn Rand guy, because I thought he wasn't arguing that society doesn't exist. It's just that society, he doesn't seem to believe, and I think a lot of libertarians say, society isn't something that has to exist at the butt of a gun in terms of, you know, coercive government. Society is something that can, you know, come about through people peaceably assembling, you know, and that's in the, you know, people contractually, you know, getting together to create their own organizations, their own, you know, their own groups, their own ideas without government doing it for them. You know, society isn't something, you know, society and government aren't the same thing, according to libertarians.
But government is a creature that exists within society, which we ourselves, we the people, have brought into being. That's the uniqueness of the American experiment, or it certainly was in 1787, that we got together and said, for the first time, arguably in history, I mean, you could go back to the Greeks, but this was a representative democracy, a democratic republic, rather than a pure democracy as the Greek did. It was the first time that we got together and said, we're going to create an entity within society that does not have any rights, that has only privileges, that all the rights are held by we the people, and that entity is owned by and beholden to we the people. And we're going to all acknowledge that, and if we don't want to acknowledge that, we can leave. And about 20% of the American population did leave after the Revolutionary War, and, you know, moved to Canada or moved back to England because they didn't agree with that idea.
Right. Well, unfortunately, that's something I guess a newborn can't do. But one last point. I think I lost it. Well, those were the major points, Tom.
Okay, well, that's a good start. I appreciate it, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Gabriel in New York City. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
Real happy you're on Air America now. Just, you know,
thanks. Thanks for listening to us on WWRL.
I was patient and you came about. But I just want to say, like, don't these people, you know, they, what about copyright? You know, like, they're happy to fight for their copyright. Which is,
well, they view copyright
government
as a form of property, even though it's an abstraction.
Yeah, but it's enforced by government. So how you know,
that's
like,
right.
And, you know, if their bank goes under at FDIC or Fannie Mae, one of these things, like,
well, so you don't think that there should be FDIC or Fannie Mae?
They don't think their money should be
libertarians, no. Libertarians and objectivists and the true conservatives, the Grover Norquist, there should be no regulatory agencies. There should be no backstopping at all. If you were dumb enough to put your money in a bank that ripped you off, tough luck.
Then what about money itself? What, do they want to carry bullion around in their pockets and pay
that's
for
right,
things?
That's right. Let's go back to the gold standard.
I can't even begin to understand that.
Yeah, well, the problem is, as I said, these people, to a large extent, are in power in the United States right now, not just major thinkers. Gabriel, thanks for the call. It's a good point. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR, just a few seconds before we've got to take a break here.
Okay, very quickly. These people don't have any sense of community or responsibility. It's in our best interest, you know, for our safety and welfare, not just in this community, but in the country itself, for us to stand by one another. I mean, if we were just individual states, we would be susceptible to attack by other foreign nations.
No, I agree, but that's the point where they say, as soon as we say we have to stand together for our protection, they say, wait a minute, I don't need no nanny state. I mean, that's the point at which they'll try and turn it around on you. But, you know, good point, JR. Good point. Well said. And thank you for your brevity. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
As a young man, I found politics into Bush's arm I dove. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. 'Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee. Well, I raised the right and squashed the left. The stars and bars you fly. Oh, excuse me, make that stars and stripes. The time, how it speeds by. Oh, Dick Cheney.
Ah, Dick Cheney, yes indeed. It's the official Karl Rove song. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Britt in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Britt, to the program.
Well, I'm listening to the Detroit. And
Britt, I'm sorry, your cell phone is breaking up so bad, I can't hear you. You'll have to grab a landline and try and call back. And let me just say, as a general rule of thumb, if you call on a cell phone, beware, because it's always better to use a landline. Gene in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to say thank you and a good book on that latest book you put out there.
Screw the
yes.
Undeclared War Against Middle Class.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank
good book, good read. My comment was was that humans at some point have asked themselves whether or not they're committed to making money, material wealth, their number one thing, or are they going to be committed to helping not only themselves but their fellow man out at the same time.
Right.
And that was basically my only comment. Also,
well, it's well said, Gene. And that really ultimately is the cleavage between conservatives and liberals. Back in the 1950s, as I recall, at the Rand Corporation, might have been the 1960s, there was a thinker, a fellow who, John Nash was his name, but they made a movie about him called A Beautiful Mind, which really kind of sanitized the whole thing. And he came up with this idea that everybody is an individual, everybody should be working for their own self-interest, and ultimately everybody will screw everybody else. And they created this paradigm called the prisoner's dilemma. And this was the basis of the Cold War, by the way. And it turned, and keep in mind, John Nash was a paranoid schizophrenic at the time, and yet he was one of the nation's greatest mathematicians. But he came up with this, the prisoner's dilemma, where if I have a stolen diamond that's worth $1 million, and you have $1 million and you're willing to buy it from me, how do we make the transfer in a way that I'm safe and you're safe? So I go dig a hole in a field and I put my diamond there, and you go dig a hole in another field someplace else and you put the money there, and then we call each other and give each other the location. Now, in the prisoner's dilemma, in all cases, the greatest self-interest would be to lie about the location, because that way you double the probability that at least you're going to end up, at the very least, you're going to end up still holding the diamond or the cash, and you may even end up with the other guy's stuff. But when they tried this at the Rand Corporation with the secretaries, when they actually had them do this, not actually go out and dig fields, but try the prisoner's dilemma game, the secretaries always told the truth. Both parties told the truth. And it turns out that when they looked at this, about the only people that they could find who consistently acted in a totally selfish fashion were economists and psychopaths. Adam Curtis does a brilliant job of laying all this stuff out in his new BBC documentary, The Trap, just as a heads up on that. Mariana in New York City. Hey, Mariana.
Hi. How are you, Tom? I respect all the information. I appreciate all the information that you offer, but I find it hard sometimes to digest some of the thoughts that are discussed by some of your guests. And I think that that term no man is an island. I mean,
yeah, from the John Donne poem.
Some of these people seem to think that that they can survive alone and they owe nothing to anyone, and I don't think they belong in government. I mean, I think they should go to Dubai and live happily. But
well, some of them are.
Right, but maybe all of them should go there, and then
yeah.
We can try to get back to the Constitution and its principles.
Yeah, it makes a certain amount of sense, Marianne. Thank you for the point. And the poem from John Donne, no man is an island entire of itself. Each is a part of the main, a piece of the continent. Blah, 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 ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. I used to have the entire poem memorized, but you're absolutely right, and it's a good point. Mary in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to call in basically because from what I know about Ayn Rand, she was a child of the aristocracy. from some part of the former Soviet Union.
Well, sort of. She was the child of a middle-class family. Her father was a pharmacist, and he lost his pharmacy business during the Bolshevik Revolution. And that was what caused her to conclude that Bolshevism and then ultimately communism was terrible. And then she studied political science at the University of Kiev, and then she came to the United States in the early 1950s.
Oh, okay. So I read that she was, you know, her family, you know, did have,
well off.
I mean, but the thing is, what she advocates is, you know, essentially feudalism.
Yes.
I mean, it essentially, you know, both, you know, political extremes do tend, you know, they do tend to advocate for what is essentially feudalism, where the rights are you know, centralized in the hands of a few.
That's right, and it's you know, you're absolutely right, Mary, and you say it very well. And in fact, it even goes beyond feudalism. It's sort of it is you know, the situation where all of the power is concentrated in a very small number of very wealthy hands, and the rest of us, you know, and then they think that a little bit of wealth will trickle down, and therefore they call the rest of us peons. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, just about a minute before we've got to wrap this hour up. What's up?
Sweet, Tom. Your conversation with Charlie Rangel yesterday inspired me, and I went to my blog and wrote a post called The Democratization of the Draft, and actually democratized the draft. And basically what it was every 6 months your recruits would be able to choose if they want to be military or non-military, so that if they were lied into a war, for example, they could say, I'm done with this. And that was
That's why, like in Germany, the draft is only for 1 year. I lived in Germany for a year, and I worked for a nonprofit organization there, Kinder in Jugendhilfsfürst Salem. And we had a whole bunch of people working there for their year as volunteers because they didn't want to go into the military. And it was a marvelous thing. They got to see the country. They traveled around. And it also gave them access to free college education, you know, as a result
of that.
That's
what it's all about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, giving people free college education, getting a year of service, giving people a transition out of high school into adult life, I think all of these things are, frankly, a desirable outcome. And I would submit to you that if everybody had some connection with the military in that context, even though the vast majority wouldn't go into the military, we would not engage in wars. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And welcome back. Pile of stuff in the news today. Karl Rove's PowerPoint presentation out over the General Services Administration. John McCain bites the dust. Just a whole bunch of stuff. I'll give you some of those in just a moment. First, time to learn Chinese. Yes, our Chinese alert for the day. I actually love this music. When I was in Beijing, I picked this up. It's like this opera about this woman whose husband goes off to sea. And anyhow, transaction in China's real estate market. This is from Breitbart.com. Surged 69% in 2006, funded to a great extent by foreign investment. A leading research firm said Wednesday there's increasingly more investment going into industrial property. Kenny Ho, a Shanghai-based head of research with Jones Lang LaSalle, a real estate money management and services firm, told Agence France-Presse. This from AFP, actually, is the source of this. Despite government measures to cool the real estate market, Chinese heady growth in the past and strong potential for the future have made it a magnet for cross-border investors. Chinese economy saw its fourth consecutive year of double-digit growth in 2006, and the report forecast the country's 2007 growth at 9.5%. Now, that in and of itself, nothing wrong with that. Isn't it great? Another country is growing. But when that other country is essentially a dictatorship, and it has become the, you know, one of the world's sterling examples of capitalism, What it does is it demonstrates the fact that capitalism does not require democracy. It blows a hole in this theory that has been promulgated by apologists on the right for the longest time, that if we simply bring unfettered laissez-faire capitalism into a country, it will solve all problems and it will automatically create democracy. And there are these people who really and truly believe this. You go back and you look at what happened in Iraq. Now, Iraq was one of those everybody gets a piece of the action kind of things. And as Congress is looking into things like the General Services Administration preparing a top 20 hit list of Democrats in Congress who are vulnerable, so let's go out and do things that will make the Bush administration look good in those districts or make the Democrats look bad so that we can take those districts, which is, by the way, a clear violation of the Hatch Act. The Hatch Act that we've got around here someplace. I mean, that it's just a clear violation of that. And one of many, as Congress is turning over stone after stone and finding under all these rocks, you know, these little things scurrying away, these little Republican, oh my God, right? As Congress is doing this, let's keep in mind the twofer, the threefer that was Iraq and hope that Iraq gets investigated and the 9/11 Reichstagsgebüge fire, which was the incident that allowed George Bush to finally do what he said the day after he was installed as president by people who his father had put on the Supreme Court, three of whom who had family members working in the Bush campaign. In his first cabinet meeting, as John O'Neill, his Secretary of the Treasury, points out, the first cabinet meeting, the first topic, how do we attack Iraq? This is in January of 2001. Now, from Bush's point of view, he wanted to do that to get political capital. From Cheney's point of view, he was thinking, hey, Halliburton can make a fortune on this. And they did. Their stock went from under $10 to up over, it's around 60 now, as I recall. I mean, Halliburton made out like bandits, and Cheney's sitting here on hundreds of thousands of stock options. I mean, you know, on and on it goes. The Hatch Act, by the way, says that it's illegal to use government offices to promote political ends. I mean, that's, you know, in essence. I don't have the actual law to read to you, but that's the bottom line of the Hatch Act. So when they're holding these hearings in Congress, I mean, this is serious stuff. The Hatch Act provides for, you know, a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. Well, back in 1929, a $1,000 fine was a big deal. Here's Section 8 of the Hatch Act. Any person who violates any of the foregoing provisions of this act upon conviction shall be fined no more than $1,000 or imprisoned for not more than a year. No officer or employee of the executive branch of the federal government or any agency thereof shall take any active part in political management or in political campaigns. You know, and then it goes on and on from there. I mean, this is pretty unambiguous. So, but back to my original point. China is demonstrating that the neocons were wrong when they said, if we attack Iraq, we can prove, and this is such an important point that is never discussed in the corporate media in the United States, we can prove that the Marshall Act was an anomaly, that the Democrats should take no credit for the rebuilding of Europe and Japan. Particularly Europe with the Marshall Act. You will recall with the Marshall Act, first of all, in fact, let me back up a little bit. During the war, the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate and the presidency. And there was a Democratic senator who stood up and said to Roosevelt in public from the floor of the Senate, we're concerned that there's some war profiteering going on here. We think that there are business people who are making money on this war. And while Americans are being asked to sacrifice, women are donating their nylons to make parachutes, people are rationing gasoline and butter and food so that those things can go to the war effort. You can't buy a new car because the car factories are all manufacturing B-52s. Because of the sacrifice that Americans are making, our industry should make a similar sacrifice. Nobody should be making a buck off this war. And Harry Truman said, you're right. I mean, President Roosevelt said, you're right. He said, I don't want to see one war millionaire come out of this war. Now think of that as you're imagining the CEO of Halliburton talking about with his millions, his billions, really, and you include the assets of Halliburton, are all going to move to Dubai now. And that senator who stood up against Roosevelt said, and I want to investigate you and your administration, Mr. Roosevelt, and find out if anybody in the administration is setting up sweetheart deals so that any of their buddies, any of your political buddies, are getting rich. And Roosevelt said, go for it. And Harry Truman, Senator Harry Truman, set up the commission to investigate corruption during the war. And he found a bunch of it, and he prosecuted it. But then after the war, General George Marshall said, you know, here's a way to rebuild Europe. Instead of sending General Motors in to rebuild Europe, instead of sending Halliburton in to rebuild Europe, instead of sending Bechtel in to rebuild Europe, let's give the money, some of it gifts, some of it grants, some of it loans organized with multiple countries involved. Let's give the money to the Germans themselves so that they can hire their own companies. They will yes, they want to build buildings with cement and brick. They're going to have to rebuild their cement and brick industry. They want to have steel in their buildings. They're going to have to rebuild their steel mills. They're going to have to start from scratch, but that's fine because then they will have a scratch. And by the way, Harry Truman said to the Germans, when you are putting back your country and you're putting together your constitution, because Hitler, you know, eviscerated the constitution, when you're putting together your constitution, I have some suggestions. We have this thing called the Wagner Act we passed in 1935. And it worked out very well. Now, keep in mind, this was before the Wagner Act was diluted in 1947 with Taft-Hartley. And it gave protections to labor unions. You ought to emulate that. You should consider doing that. And I'm proposing in 1947 a national health care program, a single-payer national health care program. You ought to try something like that. And we've got the Social Security program that we did in 1935, and it's working very well. And the Germans said, that sounds like a great idea, and we'll do that. And the rebuilding of Germany was an enormous success, and it became, Germany and Japan and the United States became the three largest industrial powers in the world by 1960. Well, the conservatives look at this and say, that has nothing to do with the protection of labor. It has nothing to do with Social Security. It has nothing to do with the National Health Care Plan. It has to do with the fact that the Germans and the Japanese are industrious people. And the Iraqis are industrious people. Look at this. They built one of the most powerful nations in the Middle East. All we have to do is unfetter them. All we have to do is outlaw labor unions. All we have to do is allow multinational corporations to do anything they want. All we have to do is do away with national content laws. All we have to do is sell off all the state-run industries. All we have to do is make sure that any company in the world can go into Iraq and take all of their profits out. And that's what L. Paul Bremer did. He went in there, George Bush's old roommate from Andover, he went in there and he changed the Constitution and changed the laws to make it safe for capitalism, thinking that that would bring about democracy. And all they had to do was look at China to see that democracy and capitalism don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Bombers and trucks carrying chlorine attached to a local government building in Fallujah in western Iraq. 15 Iraqi and U.S. service security forces were injured. In Mahawil, a car bomb in a crowded market killed 5 and wounded 25. Near Baqaba, Iraqi and U.S. soldiers killed more than 25 insurgents. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed 2 civilians and wounded 10 others. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed and another wounded from indirect fire, a term generally used for mortars and rockets in Baghdad's heavily fortified international green zone. In Baghdad, a U.S. government contractor was killed as a result of a rocket attack in the green zone. They're getting into the green zone, guys. In Anbar province, insurgents killed a U.S. Marine on Tuesday. U.S. forces captured 19 suspected insurgents in Anbar. In Ramadi, a suicide car bomb killed one civilian. And a British soldier was shot and wounded at headquarters in Basra. And John McCain says that the general drives around in an unarmored Humvee. Not true, but that's what he says. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the sky, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
Indeed. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. In the chat room, Mothlin, I'm guessing, says, damn right, Tom, capitalism does not need democracy to work. Capitalism is an economic system that can work in any political system, socialism, monarchy, communism, etc. And Chander says, 9/11 Reichstag fire? Did I just hear you say that? Wow. Good on you, Tom. Oh, yeah. 9/11 was Bush's Reichstag fire, and he was looking for it. He got it. And, you know, whether he allowed it to happen, thinking that it would benefit him politically or not, I think is frankly an open question. Whether he participated in it, I'm pretty skeptical about that, but I'm willing to be convinced. The fact of the matter is that there have been no thorough investigations of 9/11 up until this point, and we need one. We need several. We need dozens. I mean, here we are, what, 40 years, 50 years later? Almost 50 years after the Kennedy assassination? Well, that was 63, so that's what, yeah, 43 years later, and 44 years later, and still no, well, I would say our book is the definitive book. It's Ultimate Sacrifice that Lamar Waldron and I wrote that kind of laid to rest much of it, but there's still a lot of open questions. And hopefully it won't take over 40 years to figure out what happened on 9/11, although it may, so much of the evidence was destroyed. Anyhow, there's a lot going on. John McCain, speaking of Iraq, this is incredible. When this happened yesterday, Louise, my wife, came and grabbed me and said, she says, you got to come see this. You know, and we've got one of those TV things, you know, where you can replay it, you know, DVR. And she back forwarded it to McCain talking to Wolf Blitzer and said, this is incredible. Listen to this.
Everything we hear that if you leave the so-called green zone, the international zone, and you go outside of that secure area, relatively speaking, you're in trouble if you're an American.
Now, this is Wolf Blitzer on CNN, and he's pointing out, he says, everything we've heard, and CNN has correspondents on the ground, and they have satellite links, and they look at Baghdad every single day. And so John McCain then replies.
You know, that's the way you ought to catch up on things, Wolf. General Petraeus goes out there almost every day in an unarmed Humvee.
Wait a minute. General Petraeus goes out almost every day in an unarmed Humvee?
I think you ought to catch up. You see, you are giving the old line of 3 months ago. I understand it. We certainly don't get it through the filter of some of the media.
Oh, the media is all filtered, and this is the old line from 3 months ago.
But I know for a fact of much of the success we're experiencing, including the ability of Americans in many parts. Not all. We've got a long, long way to go. We only got two of the five brigades there to go into some neighborhoods in Baghdad in a secure fashion.
Yeah, so you can walk around Baghdad now holding hands with General Petraeus, and you got nothing to worry about. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Just ask John McCain. This raises the question in my mind. By the way, Wolf then turned to David Ware, his correspondent, in the CNN correspondent in Iraq, and said, Michael Ware, excuse me, thank you, and said, does this make any sense to you, Michael? And
has there been this improvement that Senator McCain is speaking about?
Well, I'd certainly like to bring Senator McCain up to speed if he ever gives me the opportunity. And if I have any difficulty hearing you right now, Wolf, that's because of the helicopters circling overhead and the gun battle that is blazing away just a few blocks down the road.
Yeah, everything's fine here, other than that helicopter up there and the gun battle just down the road. Yeah, let's just drive around in our unarmored Humvee. There's no problem. Well, you know, to just kind of summarize, Michael Ware just blew this thing apart. What I find interesting about this, though, is the whole McCain thing. One of three things is going on. Either, And keep in mind, my the point that I made in the first half of this hour, where I was setting this thing up and laying the foundation for this argument. Either these people who believe, and they really do believe it, or at least believed it, and there are still some who believe it, who believe that somehow unregulated, unrestrained, laissez-faire capitalism will bring about democracy if you just give it time. And therefore, that's what they imposed on Iraq. Keep in mind, that's not what we have here in the United States. What we have here in the United States is regulated capitalism. In fact, what you have in every industrialized country in the world is regulated capitalism. In some countries like Sweden and Norway and Denmark, it's very highly regulated. Germany and Japan, very highly regulated. In other countries, it's far less regulated. Many of the developing and underdeveloped third world countries of the world, where you have oligarchies, you end up with 20, 30 families who basically own the country. But there is no country where you have absolutely unregulated capitalism, unless you're looking at maybe Sudan. It's just total chaos. Well, even there, it's just total chaos. But these guys actually believe that capitalism is somehow going to bring about democracy. And capitalism is an economic system, and it's a reasonably good economic system when it operates within appropriate boundaries. Democracy is a political system. And that's what they don't get. They just don't get that. And so back to McCain, the question is, number one, is McCain a true believer in this notion? And has he so believed it and that he's become delusional? Could it be his age? I mean, that's a question a lot of Republicans have to be asking. McCain in his 70s, is this some form of pre-dementia or pre-senile dementia or even early Alzheimer's? Is he delusional? Does he actually believe this to be the fact? Or is he lying? Because he thinks that if he, the big lie, to quote Tom DeLay saying that liberals are like Hitler and that they use the big lie. Well, is this a big lie coming from John McCain? Or is he being lied to by his own advisors? And if so, why? Is it because they're trying to sabotage him? Are they really Bushies? I mean, keep in mind, John McCain was the guy that in 2000 looked like he was going to be the presidential nominee. And all he had to do was take South Carolina. And so Karl Rove went down there and cranked up one of these push polls where they called up people, and John McCain and his wife, to their credit, have adopted a child from Bangladesh who has dark skin. And he was a war hero and a prisoner of war. So they called up 10,000 registered Republican voters in South Carolina and said, this is called a push poll, and said to them, if you knew, they didn't say that it was true. They posed it as a hypothetical. They said, if you knew that John McCain had a child out of wedlock with an African-American woman, and he and his child and his wife are now raising that child, how would that change your vote for John, your thought about John McCain in the election? If you knew that John McCain had been undergoing psychiatric treatment for years and had post-traumatic stress disorder and was on medication because of his being a prisoner of war for 5 years, how would that change your opinion of John McCain as president? If you knew that John McCain's wife had been institutionalized and was being given psychiatric drugs, how would that change your opinion of John McCain as a candidate? They asked these three questions. It didn't matter what the answer was. They wanted to get the meme out there. And they weren't making assertions of fact. They were asking them as hypothetical, so it wasn't a violation of the law. And as a result of that push poll, John McCain lost South Carolina. George Bush took it, and that's what took George Bush to the White House in 2000. That and, the votes of several of his daddy's friends on the Supreme Court and the ability to stop the count in Florida. But, that's what got him the nomination for president. So could it be that John McCain actually believes this because there are people on his staff telling him this? And could it be that those people who are on his staff telling him this were put there by Karl Rove? At this point, I'm willing to believe anything from these guys. I'm just willing to believe anything from them. Raj in Manhattan, what are your thoughts on it? Hey, Raj.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi, Tom. Thank you, Raj, for taking my call. Tom, we would like to make it clear as much as possible regarding John McCain that, as a progressive commentator, you or anybody else should not on the air say things that could be incorrect. Like when you say John McCain is not telling the truth, I would rather prefer that we started talking about saying He's a damn liar.
But see, here's the problem, Raj. Maybe he believes he's telling the truth, in which case he's not a liar.
The point is that whether he believes or not, as long as you are making a statement on that, it is coming out of your mouth, that means you are saying it. That means you are liable. If I kill a person with a gun, I'm liable.
No, but this is a different thing, Raj.
No.
Your point is taken, and I understand your point. But if my question, I'm not disputing the fact that John McCain's wrong. In fact, I'm asserting it. My question is, why is he wrong? Why did he make that statement? Did he make that statement because he is, to quote you, a damn liar? Did he make that statement because he believes it to be true? I mean, there's a huge difference there, and I think it's an important and significant one. Gary in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hey, Gary, we just have about 20 seconds here before we've got to take a break. A quick one?
You know, I'd like to pull the last hour and this hour together, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the neocon argument and Ayn Rand and failed marriages and relationships are based on a lack of common good or ultimate realizing reality.
Mm-hmm.
They don't work for they're working for themselves and not for a common good of everybody, community.
Right. So they're operating on false assumptions.
Yeah,
good point. Good point, Gary. And that's this idea that we are all in this together, that we are community here in the United States. It was the founding notion of this country. And these conservatives like Grover Norquist, who want to drown government in a bathtub, they completely deny what this country was founded on. Thanks, Gary. 45 minutes past
you. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by and for we the people of planet Earth. I mean, if we don't include all living things, frankly, in our worldview, we're going to be toast. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Victoria, good morning, or good afternoon, or whatever it is.
Whatever it is, exactly. It's a good one, and I'm glad to talk to you on this day when the White House, not the White House correspondents, the radio and television correspondents get together to join with President Bush in eating and drinking at the Hinckley Hilton, as it's called, which is the Washington Hilton to most people, but it's known as the Hinckley Hilton because that's where President Reagan got shot by Hinckley. And we'll be very interested to know what it in fact is that the president has to say tonight. He usually gives a very jokey speech, and this, of course, is the place where he gave the speech about finding WMDs, or rather not finding them in the White House.
Yeah, is it under that desk? Is it under that table? Is it under that drawer?
Yeah.
That was so in such bad taste.
It was in bad taste. I mean, these things are always in some kind of bad taste, but that one really, he set a level.
Yes.
And we'll see if he tops it.
It was historic.
Now, did you know that the National Review has called on Alberto Gonzalez to resign?
Really? No, I didn't know that.
Yes, they've called on Alberto Gonzalez to resign.
Of course, they're not unique in that. I mean, several Republicans now have essentially called for that, and there's just deafening silence on the Republican side of the Senate in particular about Gonzalez's fate and future.
It is. The silence is deafening. The Republicans want him gone. They want this embarrassment out of their way. They're very conscious that 2 years is a short time. Those in the House are aware that 2 years is a very short time, and you've got a third of the Senate, of which a good number of them are Republicans who are up for re-election in 2 years. They're aware that 2 years is a very short time. They want this thing over, and they feel it's bleeding. And they know that it's not doing them any good to have him stay there. And another thing that needs to happen, I think many people feel, is that he's scheduled to go before the Senate Judiciary Committee on April the 17th. That's 3 weeks away. That's a heck of a long time. The feeling is, from some people, look, somebody needs to tell him to contact a committee to see if he can speed this thing up.
Right. Get it over with. Now, meanwhile, over at the General Services Administration investigation, Mr. Braley was asking the administrator, here's just a little
what clip. This means is that the Republicans are trying to target these seats to win them back in 2008. That was what was discussed at the presentation.
This is Bruce Braley, or Braley, rather, the Democrat from Iowa's 1st District.
Appreciate your interpretation of that.
I'm going to yield for 1 minute. Yeah. I just want to verify, did you know that your office supplied this chart to us?
Yes, I did, but I did not review the actual data. There was...
She's just, you know, this is Loretta Doan, or Doan. She's the administrator of the General Services Administration, and this is a PowerPoint presentation that Karl Rove put together that was given to government employees, people in the GSA, that listed the top 20 Democratic seats that were vulnerable to Republican takeover in the 2008 election if the government was able to go in and dole out favors in those districts. This is a clear violation of the Hatch Act, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's very interesting that you mentioned the Hatch Act, because in connection with the outside email addresses, i.e. of the RNC and Bush Cheney 2004, which we know that White House officials have been using, Dana Perino has been making the point, oh, well, people are very careful not to be in violation of the Hatch Act, and so that's why sometimes they use these outside email addresses. So clearly there are violations and violations of the Hatch Act.
Yeah, and now we understand that people in the White House are going to have gone to away from using the RNC website servers for their email, and they've simply picked up private accounts with local providers and gotten Blackberries and various devices of the same sort. And they're you know, one person said, "How do you guys keep in touch?" And he said, "Instant messaging and text." And where presumably there's no subpoenaable record whatsoever. This is like, you know, Marcello and Trafficante sitting around talking about the Kennedy assassination in 1962. You know, it's like, you know, well, let's make sure nobody's listening in. There's no transcript of this, is there? You know,
it's very scary. But I'm not sure that stuff can't be subpoenaed. Why can't it be?
Well, because it's not stored on anybody's server anywhere, I don't think. Actually, it probably is, because the NSA has got these companies tracking your email.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Everything's being tracked. Yeah.
Maybe they've suspended that now, all of a sudden. I don't know.
That's a good point.
But you know, if it's Karl Rove's Verizon account to Scooter's, well, or somebody other than Scooter, he's out of the loop now, but you get the point, to Scooter's private account that's, say, an AT&T account, or Singular account. I guess Singular and AT&T are now the same thing. But if it's private account to private account and doesn't even go through the RNC, there's not an entity that can be easily subpoenaed to grab that email, is there?
Not that I can think of, and it would seem to me that some kind of rule is going to have to be put in place at some point that says that you're not allowed to conduct any kind of official White House business on private servers.
Right, which raises the really bigger question, and that's the largest frame of all here, and that is, why is the White House, why is this administration, and not just the White House, by the way, why are so many Republicans behaving like the mob used to in the 1950s?
Well, they would say that they're not. I mean,
but, you know, you've got Gonzalez's assistant reporting directly to Gonzalez and reporting directly to Karl Rove, the liaison to the White House, saying, I've been taking the fifth.
And she says that because the Democrats are meanies.
Yeah, right. And they're using private email accounts. This just, even if everything is fine, there's no impropriety here. The appearance of it is horrible.
The appearance of it is horrible, because to most people who go to work and work for a company, you know that you can send emails on the company email. You know that it looks funny if you start sending emails on your home email. You know that you're...
Well, you know, yeah, I do a radio show on a Clear Channel station here in Portland, Oregon, KPOJ, and every morning when I log in, I get this, you know, five-paragraph message that says, "We may read your email. If you agree with that, click OK. If you want to have access to it." I mean, you know, that's just standard in corporate America, but these guys are even trying to get around that. Anyhow, thanks a lot, Victoria.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You know how sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you know what you don't know. And this is John McCain's big problem. Apparently he knows what he doesn't know. And sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes even everything you know is...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, is sponsored by theliberalstore.com with a T-H-E in there. All things liberal in bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's the, T-H-E, liberalstore.com. David Weil is with us. He's the author of a new book, Full Disclosure, The Perils and Promise of Transparency. He's also professor of economics and Everett W. Lord Distinguished Faculty Scholar at Boston University School of Management. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Tell us, I believe it was Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, who said that sunshine was the best disinfectant in the context of the law. You suggest that transparency is essential for democracy.
That's exactly right. And in fact, a lot of our work is really influenced and inspired by what Brandeis said about sunshine. The problem is that transparency, or just giving more information, doesn't always do what we hope it will do, in Brandeis's terms.
How so?
Well, the book is about, we have all these choices we face all the time, whether it's buying food or selecting a restaurant to go to or picking a neighborhood to live in. And a lot of folks, particularly corporations, businesses, give us lots and lots and lots of information. But sometimes the most important information we want, things about risk, health risk, aren't there, or at least aren't readily available to us. And so it makes some of the most important ways we might make decisions very hard to do.
That's something very different from transparency, though, isn't it, David? Well, by the way, your website, transparencypolicy.net, for our listeners who might want more information. We're talking with David Weil, the author of Full Disclosure. That's government doing something to gather information and then conveying that information to we the people. I always thought of transparency as, you know, the exact opposite of what the Bush administration is trying to do right now by using, you know, secondary and tertiary email accounts so that nobody can keep track of the communications within government. I thought that transparency was our ability to look inside the sausage factory and see the sausage being made in within government.
And it's you're absolutely right. It's about being able to see how the sausages are being made in government, but also in businesses. And we write about transparency, whether it's about government institutions or businesses. There are a lot of laws, sort of the Bush administration set aside for a moment, that say we should have and actually provide this information. The problem is very often the way that information is conveyed, it provides no usefulness to all of us consumers or people who are in a democracy, the information we need in the form we need it.
Yeah.
And so the information is there, but it's not in a form we can really use it. And
let's go ahead.
No, sorry.
Now let's step this out to the largest frame possible.
Okay.
I think, and that is that the traditional form of governance in Western society has not been democracy. It's been kingdoms and feudalism. Kingdoms as the political system and feudalism as the economic system.
Right.
And kingdoms and feudalism, because they violate the will of the vast majority of the people. The vast majority of people would like to have some say in governance, and they would like to have economic opportunity. Kingdoms and feudalism require opacity. They require a lack of transparency.
Right.
And it seems to me that our business system, you know, regular, raw, laissez-faire capitalism, you know, Karl Marx really diagnosed this correctly in Das Kapital, that it is really a form of feudalism, that corporations are merely a modern reinvention of kingdoms, and the extent to which they are made democratic is the extent to which labor has power, and we had to force that by the power of governmental law in 1935 with the Wagner Act,
mm-hmm.
enabling labor unions, and the extent to which government can force them to be transparent. And then on top of that, the extent to which government is democratic is the extent to which we, the people, force our elected officials to be accountable to us and be transparent. Mr. Nixon, you will give us those tapes, for example.
Right. Sure.
That sort of thing. And it seems that in the corporate arena, transparency is being fought tooth and nail. And in the government arena, transparency is being fought tooth and nail. I mean, here you've got George Bush. One of his first acts as president was to lock up his father's records for
right.
another 50 years and his own as well. And it seems that that's, am I correct in perhaps drawing the conclusion that that's because both these corporate entities and the current people who run our government don't believe in democracy and they really want kingdom and feudalism?
Well, I think it's very true that both on the corporate side and with this administration, there's a lot of information. You have mandatory information disclosure precisely because people don't want to voluntarily give out certain information. And the struggle of transparency policies, whether we're talking about Freedom of Information Act struggles like you're talking about with the Bush administration, or corporate financial disclosure, or even something as seemingly mundane as nutritional labeling, is always a political battle between the people who don't want to disclose the information and the public that needs that information. And very often, you're absolutely right, the people who have the most to lose from that transparency also happen to be the folks with the greatest political clout. And that's why many transparency policies, even those on the books, are often skewed towards providing either minimal information or information in a form that is very difficult for people to actually use and make changes.
So if that's the case, what do we do about it?
Well, I think there's a lot, what we look at in the book is a lot of, or a few cases, and I have to say, the pessimism of the last few remarks, I'm afraid, do characterize how a lot of our transparency policies don't deliver. But there are some cases of transparency policies that really do deliver. And those are the ones where very often because of opposing forces, whether it's environmental groups or labor unions or consumer advocacy groups, have worked really hard to push and make sure that the right information in the right form gets out there for consumers or workers or people trying to make decisions on candidates. And it's really very often a political struggle on both sides and getting folks organized to demand, again, not just that the information be out there, but it be out there in a form that really allows us to make better choices.
But the essential conundrum, it seems to me, is that the vast majority of pressure for and the major source of much transparency information, much government information that people, frankly, would rather wasn't out there, is coming from private organizations, whether it's the League of Women Voters or one of Ralph Nader's groups, or even, you know, Larry Klayman, the right-wing crank, I shouldn't call him a crank, the right-winger anyway, down in Florida who ran, started JudicialWatch.org,
yeah.
Judicial Watch, who sued, you know, the Clinton administration that led to the revelation about Monica, which you could argue was a transparency thing,
right.
And then sued the Bush administration about the Cheney Energy Task Force, and, you know, got out of them the fact that they were discussing invading Iraq in the spring of 2001 before 9/11
right.
and carving up Iraq's oil fields, but then got shut down, got you know, lost that case essentially in the Supreme Court.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It seems like it's always outside, you know, private or public interest groups, but these nonprofit groups, and it really should be our government itself which is holding itself accountable. How do we force our public officials, our elected representatives, to hold themselves and their peers accountable?
I think that's a great question, and I think one way we can do it, you know, it's a great political dodge to say, oh yes, let's give people information. And very often, I mean, take the SUV rollover disaster we had around 2000-2001. Originally, the answer to that problem was, well, let's just give people information. Well, first, the reaction was, well, we're fine, don't do anything. But when there was a public outcry, when 274 people had actually died from those kinds of collisions, there was a real force for some kind of regulatory action. It's very easy at that point to say, okay, we'll just give people information and leave it at that. And I think what the public needs to demand more of their legislators at that point in time is, in those cases where we want more information, we gotta work hard to define the kind of information we want. We gotta make sure it's the accurate information and high quality information. We can't let people off the hook just to say more information is better.
Right, and I think we can also encourage our members of the Congress, of the House and Senate right now, who are demanding transparency from the administration, to keep at it.
Absolutely.
Mr. Waxman, keep doing that great job. David Weil, he's with TransparencyPolicy.net, the author of Full Disclosure. Thank you, David. Where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A tip of the hat to Mary in Pittsburgh, who shared this story with us in the chat room. You can get to our live chat room, by the way. I hang out there during the breaks when I can, while we're live on the air at Tom Hartman. You just go to the top of TomHartman.com and click live chat. It's free. You don't have to give us any secret information to register. We don't sell or distribute anything. I mean, it's just a place you can hang out. And this story, Rumsfeld torture lawsuit dismissed in Time magazine. Former Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld cannot be tried on allegations of torture in overseas military prisons, a federal judge said yesterday in a case he described as lamentable. U.S. District Judge Thomas Hogan threw out the lawsuit on behalf of 9 former prisoners. Basically what this judge said, the lawsuit, by the way, says that the prisoners were beaten, suspended upside down from the ceiling by chains, urinated on, electrically shocked, sexually humiliated, burned with cigarettes, locked inside boxes, and subjected to mock executions. The judge was clearly horrified by this. But he said he couldn't find any precedent at law. He couldn't find any case in the past where somebody had been prosecuted for such a thing. So he couldn't cite a precedent. And he didn't want to establish a precedent because he said that if he allowed this lawsuit to go forward, then Osama bin Laden could sue George W. Bush for threatening to murder him. This seems to me like what might be referred to as tortured logic. It's really, really stringing this thing. And then Mary points out in the chat room, she says, ha! The federal judge who said Rummy can't be tried, Chief Judge Thomas F. Hogan, was appointed to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Now, keep in mind, this is the judge who refused to go against the Bush administration, who was appointed to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia in August 1982 by Republican President Ronald Reagan and became chief judge on June 19th, 2001. That would be during the Bush Jr. administration. So we've got a Reagan-Bush judge saying that the Reagan-Bush and friends cannot be prosecuted. Isn't life sweet if you're a Bushy, I guess? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Terry in Dearborn, Michigan. Terry, welcome to the program.
Great show. I love the historical facts you give out.
Thank
now,
you.
About the 8 fired U.S. attorneys, we mm-hmm. already know that
about 7-1 margin, they were prosecuting Democrats over Republicans.
Right.
I'm wondering.
And we know that broadly speaking, among all 93 attorneys, there were something, as I recall, over either 300 or 500, multiple hundreds of prosecutions of Democrats, either attempted or ongoing investigations, and fewer than 50 of Republicans.
Right, right. Now, we already know they were already, on a Republican bent. And what I'm wondering is, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, also known as CREW,
yeah,
I think they're responsible for most, if not all, of the bring attention to the Republican corruption that was prosecuted.
No,
so I'm wondering,
they shoved it in the face of the U.S. attorneys and said, are you going to do something about this?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So it might have been even worse. And as a result, I'm wondering if they're basically responsible for getting those eight fired, which would be a good thing.
We've had representatives of CREW on the program before, and you raise a really interesting point, Terry, and I think it would justify our getting somebody from CREW back on the program and discussing this with them, because you're right. They have brought to the public's knowledge so many of these things, and it would be interesting to find out, how many of these prosecutions of Republicans came about as a result of their efforts, and how many prosecutions of Democrats came about because the prosecutors who are still on the job are doing what they perceive to be the job that Bush put them in place to do, which is hurt Democrats, help Republicans. And Terry, thanks a lot for the call. That's one of the big things that concerns me, frankly, is I am concerned and frankly horrified by the firing of the prosecutors who were fired. And in fact, I wrote an op-ed piece that you can find over at commondreams.org. We put it up yesterday, or they put it up yesterday. I submitted it yesterday morning. And in which I quote James Madison at length about this topic, saying that if a president wantonly dismisses a meritorious man, he should be immediately subject to impeachment. But what about the people who are kept in office? What about a president who keeps people in office because they are successfully prosecuting Democrats and turning a blind eye to Republicans? I mean, look at all the investigations that have been stopped or shut down, in many cases because prosecutors were promoted out of their positions. You know, the Tom DeLay investigations, for example, the Jerry Lewis. Well, the Jerry Lewis she was fired, the woman who was looking into Jerry Lewis. But there's a whole series of these things. And I'm frankly just as concerned about the people who are saying that, who are still in office and are doing what the Bushies want. Marilyn in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Marilyn, what's up?
Hey, first of all, thank you for all the work you're doing and for being able to stay with it through sometimes horrifying stuff. And the reason I'm calling is I heard you yesterday talking about this apparent attack that the U.S. is going to conduct on Iran using nuclear warheads of some sort.
Yeah, Operation Bite on April 6th. In fact, I was just during one of the breaks corresponding with Heather Volkusch, who lives and blogs from Vienna, Austria, on this topic and is often published in the progressive media. And she's writing about it and, asking, has this really broken through in Europe into the mainstream press, or is it more of a Daily Kos type story there? And she said that the Russian press is all over it. But Le Monde and Spiegel have not yet picked it up. But it's being certainly discussed in Europe big time.
Well, do you think that there's anything that we can do or your listeners can do to activate networks or to substantiate in some way what you're saying so that it becomes more believable to the American population?
Well, first of all, we have to determine, and I think this is what Heather and I were talking about in email, we have to determine whether the information is Putin trying to provoke or prevent something. In other words, whether this was a Russian leak for Russian purposes that have nothing to do with anything that might be in the best interest or the worst interest of the United States or not, and whether it's true or not, number one. And that apparently hasn't been substantiated. I mean, what we know for a fact is that the Russians are claiming that this is true and that they're claiming that their intelligence sources have it and that it's solid. And, Russia has a fairly formidable intelligence service and typically their intelligence is reasonably good. On the other hand, the intelligence services of other nations, if they know about this, are keeping it close to the vest. And that may mean one of two things. It may mean that it's very real and we have enlisted allies and they're all keeping it quiet, much like, you know, you look back at the Downing Street memo in June of 2002, or maybe it was July, in the summer of 2002, there was a meeting in Downing Street in the equivalent of the White House there in the United Kingdom, where they sat around and they said, you know, the President of the United States is determined to attack Iraq. It's going to happen, period. We can't stop him. And so what we have to do is fix the intelligence to match the policy of the invasion. So we better come up with something to substantiate this. That was back, you know, long, that was even 5 months before Bush was saying that he hadn't. I mean, Bush was saying...
He said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And, you know, that was in late 2002. So you know, either it's that or it's something else. And I frankly don't know. None of us know. And we're just going to, I think the only, you know, the old Louis Brandeis quote, you know, the best disinfectant is sunshine. The only way we're going to prevent this, frankly, or find out about it is by talking about it. So, you know, I do, and I encourage you to, Marilyn, as well. Thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. Ivan in New York City. Hey, Ivan, what's on your mind today? Ivan?
Yes, salute you, Tom. I had a general comment, which would round up that we are wasting a little bit of time talking about principles, laws of a democracy here, while we are in a big trouble, a true trouble. Bush is for 5 years now, fifth year, killing Iraqis and bleeding us to death. Yeah. Is it stupid? Is he misinformed by his agencies?
No.
He is definitely arrogant.
No, he was clearly informed. I mean, when Berlusconi first brought that phony thing about, I'm sorry, we're getting terrible feedback here. When Berlusconi first brought that document to him that Italian intelligence cobbled together about Niger, Bush handed it off to the CIA and they said, no, this is phony. And it took them 6-8 months to recycle it back through British intelligence so that he could refer to it in his State of the Union address. These guys cooked the books on this thing. There's no doubt about it. And they did it, in my opinion, for political purposes. They did it because Bush thought that he was going to get political capital. I mean, he told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, back in 1999, if I get a chance to invade, if I'm elected president and I get a chance to invade Iraq, I'm going to have a successful invasion and I'm going to get done everything I want to get done, which means rolling back the New Deal. It's undoing Roosevelt. That's what these guys have been working on ever since 1930, ever since the 1930s, ever since, you know, 1935, all the Republicans voted against Social Security. They voted against the law that brought in the National Labor Relations Act. I mean, consistently, in 1947, they voted against the National Health Care Plan, and it continues. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
But we could change it. Welcome back. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. You see, 26 years now, we've been under the thumb of conservative economic ideology. And I include, to a large extent, the Clinton administration in that because of that meeting that Bill Clinton had a week before he was inaugurated with Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, in which they convinced him that the platform that he campaigned on, which was an FDR campaign, and that he won on, an FDR platform, should not be the platform that he should govern on. And it wasn't. And I think, you know, all the more the tragedy for the United States, because frankly, I think if he had ignored Greenspan and Rubin and followed his own instincts and followed what he had campaigned on, that America would be all the better for it. this in the BBC today. And tip of the hat to Shelby for this. U.S. no longer technology king. The U.S. has lost its position as the world's primary engine of technological innovation, according to a report by the World Economic Forum. The U.S. is now ranked 7th in that body's league table, measuring the impact of technology on the development of nations. A deterioration of the political and regulatory environment in the U.S. prompted the fall. You get this? The laissez-faire, let them do whatever they want, let them make as much money as they want, theology that is driving the Reagan, the Bush, the Clinton, and the Bush administrations has moved us below countries that say, well, yeah, it's fine if you want to make money, but you do have to spend some money on innovation and development, and you can't just take all your money and distribute it to your stockholders as dividends. And by the way, we're not going to tax dividend income at only 15% the way Bush does, and everybody who works for a living has to pay in the 30s. Everybody pays the same amount of tax. Number one in the world in terms of networked readiness, business innovation. Number one, Denmark. Number two, Sweden. Two highly regulated economies, highly regulated capitalism, and very democratic nations. Number three, Singapore, which is not a particularly democratic nation. It's a friendly dictatorship, I would argue, having been there myself, having had my hotel room sacked once because I made the mistake of talking about political action in a public speech. But they also highly regulate capitalism in Singapore. Number four, Finland, a democracy. Number five, Switzerland. Number six, the Netherlands. These countries are all ahead of the U.S. in terms of innovation in the business sector. Why? Because some regulation of the business sector is actually good for it. It's actually good for capitalism. And you can make a very, very, very strong case that Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself when he stepped in during the Republican Great Depression. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York on the line. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind?
Thanks, Tom. Referring back to the sunshine disinfectant discussion.
Yeah.
It's been said that a half the truth is often equal to a big whole lie. And when you have this administration, it sometimes seems like it's just a PR campaign spin machine masquerading as an administration. They've found new ways to lie. Obfuscate, dissemble. Alberto Gonzalez, when he said he would never fire anyone for political reasons, now he said that he gave, get this is a euphemism, incomplete information. Incomplete is the word. And the other one, yesterday, very underreported in the hearing with Mueller, Spector asked him, what about the firing of Carol Lam? Because the head FBI agent in San Francisco said that her firing would interfere with further prosecutions. It would hinder them and possibly endanger further prosecutions. Mueller said that the head FBI agent had been, get this, here's the euphemism, misquoted. Later in the hearing, Dianne Feinstein brought him back to this and said, the FBI agent, the head FBI agent in San Francisco, who said that Carol M's firing would endanger further prosecutions, did he not say that? And Mueller admitted, yes, he said that, but we warned him that he shouldn't talk about it. That was Mueller's version of misquoting. So, I mean, they're obdurate obfuscators. They're acolytes of Ananias, I guess. There's such a lack of accountability there. The Pat Tillman thing still it riles me so much.
I know. You're spot on, Charlie, and thanks for pointing it out. It's well said. And the small lies are piling up and piling up, and eventually that house of cards is going to fall over. In fact, I think it is right now. Mike in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. I'd like to go back to the main war on terror thing.
Yeah.
And if that seems to have been the whole reason why the Bush administration was installed in 2000, and it seems to be the reason why it...
Well, not 2000, because there was no war on terror in 2000. It was 2002, 2004, and 2006.
Well, in... 2001 September 11, it got more power with the Patriot Act.
Yeah, no, that's my point. That's when the phrase came into usage. It was after 9/11. They started using that phrase.
Okay, well then let me use that term loosely then. Okay. My question to you is, and to your listeners, is this: is all the illegitimacy that's being uncovered in the Bush administration going to rub off on their whole reason, I think, reason for being, which is this war on terror, and render it illegitimate also.
I think it already is, and it already has. And I think it's one of the reasons why you very rarely these days hear Republicans, other than the most ideological, you know, the David Dreyers out there hard to say. I was going to say, you know, Graham or Specter or Lindsey Graham, you know, to some extent. But by and large, I think most Republicans are starting to back away from that because you're right. It's just simply wrong. There should be a criminal prosecution of people who committed a crime against the United States. And not to mention the crimes that are happening right now. Coming up tomorrow, Sam Kasman and I are going to debate whether the FDA should regulate tobacco as a drug. Marlene Winnell is here about her book, Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. And as always, the best of the rest of the news. That and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.